Welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman, the monthly collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT and the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center. Victoria Loutman's guest this month is Lionel Shriver. Graver Capital Management, LLC, proudly presents these broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman, which is also made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue is one of the world's best academic bookstores, and it carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Uncommon Sense, Economic Insights from Marriage to Terrorism by Gary S. Becker and Richard A. Posner, just released by the University of Chicago Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Hardball, a V.I. Warshawski novel by Sarah Paretsky, published by Putnam. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. They're recommending Chicago, a biography by Dominic A. Pasiga, beautifully produced by the University of Chicago Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com.
Well, thank you. What a lovely welcome. Welcome to Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Loutman. We are here at the Harold Washington Library. I have to tell you that this is the last season after 6 years. The show will end in June, but I still would like to thank Graver Capital Management, LLC. They have continued to underwrite the series, even up to its end, and also to Seminary Bookstore Co-op for bringing so many books here. You can listen to the past 6 seasons of Writers on the Record at victorialoutman.com. And for instance, dozens, I mean, really like 50 authors, Edwige Danticat, Jonathan Safran Foer, Michael Cunningham, Louise Erdrich. It goes on and on and on. They'll be there in perpetuity. But today, our guest sitting here, I have to say that if you were to mention her name, if you say to people how much you enjoy the work of Lionel Shriver, how much you enjoy her writing, the response will either be near rapture or a blank stare followed by, now, what did he write? In fact, she ditched her given name, Margaret Ann, at age 15, and then Lionel Shriver left her home state of North Carolina not long after, living the most peripatetic life in New York and Israel and Nairobi and Bangkok, Belfast, and finally London, where she has been for over a decade. Now, Shriver wrote 7 novels between 1986 and 1997, but none of them really attracted those fat advances or the bestseller listings until everything changed in 2005 when her novel number 8, We Need to Talk About Kevin, won the prestigious Orange Prize, was translated into like 24 languages and made Shriver a literary star at the tender age of 48. Her next book, The Post-Birthday World, that is the most deliciously spicy book. If you haven't read it, I urge you to buy it tonight. It also became a bestseller. And by now, of course, legions of rabid Shriver fans, like all of you, know her to be one of the most uncompromising, witty, smarty pants, insightful authors around, completely unafraid to tackle the topics that just make you squirm. Her new book is no exception. So Much for That. And it's, according to the author, the most entertaining novel about illness and death you'll read this year. I am very excited to welcome Lionel Shriver to Writers on the Record. Thank you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. say that. I like that characterization, smarty pants.
I thought smarty pants. I couldn't really say that about a lot of people, but I figured I could say that about you, and you'd actually think that was a good compliment, which it is. It's meant as a compliment.
Yes, I definitely take it that way.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm glad, since we haven't met before, like a half an hour ago. Before we get into sort of the meat of this conversation, I love that you were so sure of yourself from such an early age. By age 7, you knew that you wanted to be a writer. That is what you want to be, and you even started to pursue it pretty quickly after making that decision, right?
Yes, and in fact, I made the announcement to a grown-up friend of my parents. I was probably about 8 by that time, and I said that what I wanted to do was grow up and illustrate my own books. And he stooped down and said, "But won't you want to write books for grown-ups?" And I hadn't really thought about it, and I said, "Well, I guess." And then he said, "But grown-up books don't have pictures."
Oh.
That really annoyed me and stuck in my craw. So when I grew up and became a writer with my second book, Checker and the Derailers, I did pen and ink drawings of my characters, and I forced my publisher, Farrar Straus, to reduce them and put them at the beginning of the chapter headings, and I thought, so there.
Well, you were pretty much ahead of the curve.
So that's smarty pants.
There's the smarty pants from age 8. Well, let's talk about this book, which has already been getting so much attention, and there's so many ways that you could really describe it, to be really basic about it, you could say that it is about two families that are very connected, they're best friends with each other, who have both become deeply affected by medical crises within their families. One that's been living it for a long time, the other where it happens very suddenly. And when people read the book and you get to the end of it, there's a very interesting and poignant acknowledgement that really it was one very close friend of yours that I think must have been the inspiration for this book. You talk about how you had a friend who became ill with the same illness that Glynis is afflicted with in this, mesothelioma. That's a mouthful. I had to
peritoneal mesothelioma. That's even harder.
But I guess my question to you is, did this book actually come about because of a friendship that you had, a woman, close friend of yours for 25 years, who did contract that illness and died? Or had you been sort of thinking along the lines of the American healthcare system, insurance, and that just happened to be a way into it?
Well, a lot of my novels come out of an intersection of the public and the private, and I think this is a good example of that. It's true that I did have a very close friend of 25 years who died of mesothelioma in late 2006, and that hit me pretty hard. At the same time, I can't remember, honestly, at this point, which came first. I also tripped across an article in the New York Times that documented how not only is the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country medical bills, but the majority of the people who are going bankrupt from medical bills have health insurance. And that really floored me. And when I read that, I thought, you know, that sounds like a book. And then I thought, why don't you write it?
Did you decide that you had to do, was there a tremendous amount of research then that went into it? I mean, you'd lived through this experience with your friend, and I know there were two other friends of yours who experienced illnesses that I guess were life-threatening.
Breast cancer,
and they didn't die. So you actually had to do a fair amount of medical research, but also just the insurance part of this. When the book opens, we see a bank account from Merrill Lynch at the top of the page, $700,000 in some sense. This is Shep Nacker's personal account. It's money that he's banked from the sale of his company. And over the course of the book, we watch as this, it's not a fortune, but it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. This guy's going to retire to the island of Pemba, hopefully with his family. And over the course of the book, that chunk of change gets whittled down to zero because of the American healthcare system. So over the course of this book, I mean, you must have had to really talk to a lot of people who'd gone through that exact situation.
I didn't talk to a lot of people who went bankrupt from medical bills, but I did have to do a lot of research on the medical conditions that the novel addresses. I mean, I like to think of So Much for That as a kind of medical ER, a kind of literary ER. And so there's a kind of four-ring circus going on in the book. There's the main story of Glennis and mesothelioma. There's an elderly father who has a fall, and they have to decide what to do with him, and therefore we get into, you know, the costs of nursing home or assisted living. There's a teenager in the book who has familial dysautonomia, which is even harder to say than peritoneal mesothelioma. I've been rehearsing. which is an exclusively Jewish genetic disease, one of the strangest diseases I've ever come across, which affects all kinds of parts of the body, including swallowing, blood pressure, temperature. These kids actually have to learn how to eat. Otherwise, they choke. They have to learn how to swallow. And it's very demanding for the parents. And then my favorite subplot of all, and my publisher tried to talk me out of this one because it made him nervous, but it's my favorite. Plastic surgery gone wrong.
Yes, and not in any plastic surgery that you are thinking of right now, I can tell you without giving it away. But, you know, I think it must have been extraordinary for you to be writing this book and watching with bated breath as it was about to be published, and at least here in this country, every day, front of the papers, healthcare bill, insurance, insurance, insurance. So, I mean, either you were incredibly prescient or you were really worried that something was going to happen before the book came out that was going to affect its sales.
Yeah, the timing of this is eerie, because when I started writing this book, Obama was not even a viable candidate for president, much less was he a president who was shoving healthcare reform to the top of his agenda. So I've been in a peculiar position, especially during this last year when the book was in production. And we had already set the pub date for March. And here the reform bill, you know how long it's taken. It seemed as if it was going to pass very quickly. And I was thinking, oh, no, I've really missed the boat. And so I ended up being in the perverse position of hoping that the health care reform that I ferociously supported did not pass so that my release would be topical.
So you could sell more books.
Yeah. I can't tell you how guilty that made me. My only solace was that it didn't matter how I felt, right? I mean, sometimes you just have to tell yourself this. You know, I can sit there hoping that the reform bill doesn't pass at least until April, and it doesn't affect what happens. So,
well, I suppose if Democrats could get their hands on this and just send it to every Republican, there might be an interesting response, because by the end of this book, I mean, it just makes you crazed thinking, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. This could be me in another couple of years, all of us sitting in this room, people listening. It's a terrible situation that you actually witnessed because of your friend. I mean, I read that you saw your friend, you know, subject herself to $2 million worth of medical procedures.
Yes, and it bought her about 3 months of life.
Of rotten
and
life.
And, you know, she was one of my best friends, and I can still tell you I think it was a waste of money.
Well, the question of what is a life worth wafts through this book in a lot of ways and with a lot of different people. But before that even crystallizes, we meet Shep Nacker at the start. He's actually packing. The first line is, what do you pack for the rest of your life? And we learn that this man has worked towards a dream basically his entire adult life and worked for a jerk for years who took over his company and saved all this money up because he wants to check out. He wants to retire early to what is called the afterlife, you know, very metaphorical name for that. And he's got this chunk of change saved up, and he doesn't know if his wife is going to go with him. He and Glennis have been married a long time. So what we realize in the course of this book, and you're going to read a section where we hear about how they met and what his feelings are, over the course of this book you realize that illness is what actually brings them back together. I mean, they were kind of on the outs. But illness is what sort of reaffirms their love for each other.
Well, certainly this book is primarily about the course of a marriage and what effect illness has on that marriage, and then secondarily what effect illness has on all the relationships in the book. So it's not exclusively about the state of American healthcare or
you wouldn't want to read it then.
Evil health insurance companies, though it is about that too.
Well, so why don't you read this section, which we were just discussing, that what brings Shep to Glynis? And you obviously had very specific ideas about who she was. She's quite a character.
Glynis is not good at being sick, or she at least doesn't obey the rules. None of my characters do. She's dyspeptic and angry, whereas you're supposed to be gracious and warm and brave. She's not brave, but she is mad. But this is early in the book, and this describes when they first met. When they met, Glynis had been running her own small business from home, making jewelry of a strikingly stark, streamlined nature during an era of clunk, slapdash, and feathers. She had contacted Knack of All Trades to build a work table bolted to the floor, and later, because she liked the proprietor, his broad, veined forearms, his wide-open face like a field of wheat, a set of racks for hammers, pliers, and files. Shep appreciated her meticulous requirements as she appreciated his meticulous execution. The second time he showed up to finish the table, she'd left numerous samples of her work lying casually around the studio. Deliberately, she confessed with a laugh once they started going out. She dangled the glittering baubles before her handsome handyman like fishing lures. Though he'd never considered himself the artistic type, Shep was transfixed. Delicate and morbid, a whole series of elongated stick pins looked like assemblages of bird bones. When she modeled the bracelets for him, they wrapped all the way up her arm, slithering like serpents to the elbow. Sinewy, elusive, and severe, Glynis's creations were an uncanny manifestation of the woman who made them. It was touch and go whether he fell in love with Glynis or her metalwork first, because as far as Shep was concerned, they were one and the same. During their courtship, Glynis was teaching at summer camps and doing piecework in the jewelry district to pay the rent. Meantime, she was placing single necklaces in second-tier galleries, and her silversmithing barely broke even. Yet she fevered long hours and paid her own phone bill. Surely any man would have assumed that for a self-starter like Glynis, disciplined, ascetic, and fiery, pulling her financial weight in a marriage would be a point of pride. On reflection, it probably was. So he'd never have expected to have to save for the afterlife all by himself. Less compassionate men might have felt they'd been sold a bill of goods. Pregnancy had seemed a reasonable excuse for letting her metalwork languish, but that accounted for only 18 months of the last 26 years. Motherhood wasn't the real problem, though it took him a long time to figure out what was. She needed resistance, the very quality that metal most demonstrably offered up. Suddenly, Glynis had no difficulty to overcome, no hard artisan's life with galleries filching half the too small price of a Mokume brooch that had taken 3 weeks to forge. No, her husband made a good living. And if she slept late and dawdled the afternoon away reading Luster, American Craft Magazine, and Lapidary Journal, the phone bill would still get paid. For that matter, she needed need itself. She could overcome her anguish about embarking on an object that, once completed, might not meet her exacting standards, only if she had no choice. In this sense, his helping had hurt her. By providing the financial cushion that should have facilitated making all the metal what have you she liked, he had ruined her life. Wrapped with a slackening bow, ease was a poisonous present. Yet it wasn't as if she were lazy. Since Glynis still maintained the fiction that she was a professional metalsmith, all other domestic activities therefore qualified as procrastination, and were thus seen to with vigor and dispatch. It wasn't as if she'd made nothing either, spurning jewelry as intrinsically rinky-dink, She'd moved entirely to flatware, and through the years had crafted a handful of dazzling implements. Memorably, the Bakelite inlaid fish slice, that exquisite set of hand-forged, perfectly ergonomic sterling chopsticks whose heavier ends bent slightly, achingly, as if they were melting. Yet each finished project was the product of so much agony and time that in the end she couldn't bring herself to sell it.
That's Lionel Shriver reading from her most recent novel, So Much for That. And this is before Shep. He's thinking back on, you know, kind of where did it go wrong? They're still married, but they've drifted apart, and he's annoyed and irritated and takes care of everybody, and she's kind of slackening off and sitting around and, like, looking at her old fish slice, basically, not doing any new work. And just as he has finally decided he's going to bite the bullet, he's bought the tickets, off he's going to go to this afterlife that he's planned, he's going to go with her or without her, that's when the boom is lowered and she announces that she has cancer. You know, he is a really interesting character. He's the kind of like the spouse, the boyfriend, the lover that everybody would like to have. He just, like, snaps to it at that point.
And well, Shep is a good man. In fact, he's
really
one of the
good, only
good characters I've ever written.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, how did that happen? I mean, did you ever have a moment, or did you know for sure this character, it's largely told from his point of view, that he was going to be that kind of a guy? Or did he kind of write himself? You know, did you decide he has to be good because we need a certain type of ending here?
No, I mean, having a sound, responsible character was important for this story because, after all, the dilemma at the very beginning of the book where Shep is getting ready to say, Shep says, you know, I'm leaving for the island of Pemba with or without you because I plan to do this my whole life and I don't think you're serious anymore. And you keep coming up with excuses why now is not the time to go. And as an act of loyalty to myself, I really have to go. And in fact, this is the only selfish thing Shep has ever done in his whole life. He's always been a good son. He's always been a good husband. He's always been a good father. He's the kind of guy that everybody else depends on and leans on. And he's also the kind of guy who always pays for things. You know people like that, right?
Not enough.
And not, right. And so you kind of admire him for finally doing something for himself, and that's when Gwyneth says that she has cancer. And if he were not a good man, maybe he'd still leave. But but that is the perfect thing. It's the one thing that would keep him home. He's not somebody who's going to leave his wife ill and in the lurch. And if nothing else, she needs his health insurance.
That's right. There's a lot that goes on in this book around what you do to keep your health insurance.
But well, you know, health insurance is starting to explain what people do in this country, why they make decisions, why they have a particular job, why they don't leave a job, why they have to leave a job, why they can't afford to be self-employed anymore. I mean, we are now being controlled by that, and I think it's tragic. There's another character in this book who works for IBM, and she used to be a freelance landscape person, you know, working with plants and the earth. But now she does sales outreach for IBM, and why is it? It's for the health insurance.
And you sound so much, then, like your character Jackson,
oh,
who
dear, is
the best friend of Shep. Well, I figured that was the one closest to you, who does go on these just fantastic rants about what you were just saying. And I mean, really, when you start to parse those, you do think, okay, time to write every congressman I know. But here's one of the things that keeps coming up to this book, this question of what is a human life worth? At what point do we, and they try and place value on that later in the book. I won't blow that storyline. But one of the things that is fascinating is everybody's reaction to illness in their life. And Glynis, who is this, you know, this brittle, caustic, practical-seeming person, although not particularly maternal, but she's, you know, she's got these two kids. We
Glynis
barely see them.
Is difficult.
She's difficult. But
and I love her.
I can see why, and she's wonderful, although I think I'm not sure how long I could stay in her presence. But what's fascinating is, and this is where we keep saying to ourselves all through this book, what would I do? How would I react to this? And when she gets this diagnosis, she decides she doesn't really want to go on the internet and find out what is her prognosis. And she digs in. She's the one dictating. She wants every single medical anything that she can get. She's prolonging her life.
Well, which is normal. You know, that's what we do.
Yes.
We go out and we get the best care we can, and we do whatever we can to stay alive. That is a normal human response. Where Glynis really falls down, though, is she's a very competitive person. She's a real striver. She's a perfectionist. In fact, that's one of the reasons that she doesn't produce very much metalwork, is that she never rises to her own standard. She's afraid of disappointing herself. And therefore, Glynis falls for all that talk that you hear about cancer and the battle against cancer, the arsenal of drugs at our disposal, how you have to fight the good fight. She thinks that cancer is a war, and she is determined to win. And one of the things that translates into is that in her refusal to admit defeat, she never recognizes publicly that she is dying. And it puts all of the people in her life in a very awkward position, because when it's obvious to everyone else that you're not going to make it, and you know you're not going to be buying her Christmas presents next year, you inject an artifice in the relationship and a lie. And it's especially painful between husband and wife, so that when Glynis acts as if, you know, she's going to be taking this chemotherapy and she's going to get on the other side of it, she's going to get well, then Shep can't talk to her about, you know, what is his life going to be like after she dies. You know, it denies him that intimacy, and it's tragic. It's not fair. And I actually went through this with my friend who had mesothelioma. It's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. It's one of the things I wanted to write about, because my friend wouldn't admit she was dying either. And it alienated us from each other. It meant we didn't have as close an experience of her illness as we might have. And most of all, it meant we never had that last conversation. The last time I spoke to my friend Terry, I knew it was the last time I would speak to her. And if she was thinking hard enough, if she was paying attention, she must have known too. But the way we spent that last visit, I am not kidding. We ended up spending 15 minutes talking about lumpy versus smooth mashed potatoes.
Which is a conversation that comes into the book between
mother
and daughter.
Yes, I used that detail. And it was just a terrible waste.
Yeah.
But I think the medical establishment encourages us to think that way.
Well, you go into that, and I think that's a very interesting part of the book, is the relationship with the doctors and how they, you know, promulgate it and they continue.
Well, doctors don't want to admit defeat, right? And it's true that for doctors, dying patients are a big disappointment and reflect badly on them, and that's one of the reasons that you keep patients upbeat and you sell them on this idea that, you know, you have a positive attitude and you're going to get through this. Doctors are just not oriented towards sitting you down and telling you, well, you know, this treatment that I've just put you through isn't working and you're going to die.
We're making it sound like this book is so grim. And it actually, I mean, it's horrible to say this, but it can be really funny. I mean,
it is not horrible to say this. And actually, this is one of the things that I always try to get across about this novel, because I do not think that fiction should ever be a source of suffering. I never want you to have one of my books on your bedside table and think, oh, no, I have to get back to that. Maybe tonight I'm feeling tired and I'll just go back to sleep. I mean, this book is meant to be entertaining. The biggest compliment that's been paid to me, as far as I'm concerned about this, is that the book is a page-turner. It's got a lot of energy in it. It's animated by an enormous anger, some of it political, some of it from the personalities in the book. And I hope that a lot of it is funny.
It is. It's funny. I mean, you're laughing through the, like, horror, but, you know, that's sort of a leitmotif in a lot of your books, and I think that's what drives it, is that you've got this kind of wit and intelligence to take illness and death and, like, not look at the bright side, but certainly look at sort of an amusing and almost farcical side in points. We're gonna take a short break right now, so don't go away. We'll talk in the second half and get another reading from Lionel Shriver about her new book, So Much for That. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Thanks.
You're tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and our monthly broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Graver Capital Management, LLC, proudly presents these broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which is also made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, is one of the world's best academic bookstores, and it carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Uncommon Sense, Economic Insights from Marriage to Terrorism by Gary S. Becker and Richard A. Posner, just released by the University of Chicago Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Hardball, a V.I. Warshawski novel by Sarah Paretsky, published by Putnam. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. They're recommending Chicago, a biography by Dominic A. Pasiga, beautifully produced by the University of Chicago Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record. Let me just tell you right now what is coming up next month. We still have a couple of very great programs before the end of the show. April 22nd is two-time Booker Prize winner Peter Carey coming here. This is for his second time. He was here, I think, in the second season of Writers on the Record, too. And then on May 20th, Jane Smiley, Pulitzer Prize winner, coming back with a book that's getting a lot of buzz. And then our special fun finale event on June 10th, which I hope you'll participate in. I'll give you more details about that later. But my guest today is author and journalist Lionel Shriver. North Carolina born, living in the UK for the past 20 years. Besides her 10 novels, she has written for The Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, The Economist, The New York Times. Her books include The Post-Birthday World, We Need to Talk About Kevin, We're Talking About So Much for That. And, you know, the role of parents and children in this book is really interesting, as it is in a number of your books. We meet kids of both couples. One of the kids, Flicka, is really sick. She's the teenage daughter of Carol and Jackson. They have another daughter, Heather, who's so competitive about her older sister getting all the medical attention that she takes a $60 placebo every month or every week because she wants to feel equally, like, messed up. And so it becomes almost like a farce at that point with these kids kind of battling for who gets the most medical attention. And then
I'm a little worried that that's realistic.
Is it? Well, I'm sure that is realistic,
yeah,
but
I mean,
it still seems
like a
farce.
There's a line in the book that in these children's generation, a diagnosis is the latest must-have.
And I'm sure we all know people in that category, yes. Although I wasn't aware of a placebo yet given to kids so that they could feel equally as screwed up as their friends, but possibly that exists.
I made that up, but it seemed credible.
I'm sure you're being prescient yet again. But, you know, the kids, particularly the son, this 15-year-old son of Glynis and Shep, who we almost never see, Zach. I mean, he's just in his room. What is the Japanese term you applied? The
hikikomori.
Yeah, hikikomori. These guys who, like, basically live in their rooms. They never come out.
It's apparently a big phenomenon in Japan.
It is.
Yeah, that's real.
Yes, it's real. A lot of times they have manga dolls in there with them, which is really creepy. But that's all. That's maybe your next book. But I guess between the kids who are very not comforting to their parents, I mean, really, these kids don't offer any solace. The parents are just there basically taking care of the kids. And even the adults, as the children of their own parents who appear in the book, nobody seems to have a great paternal, maternal relationship. And I think that, and even as siblings, there are problems. The next part I want you to read in the book shows the relationship between Shepherd and his sister Beryl, who is really one of the most loathsome characters in the book. I mean, you just want to slap her silly a couple times.
I think I probably plant at least one character in every book, just the character you love to hate.
So you hated her
Beryl.
Too.
That's oh, good. Yeah.
Well, so describe the part that's coming up. I mean, Shep is really getting tired of having to take care of everybody at this point.
Well, yeah. Beryl's one of those. She's a documentary filmmaker, not a very successful one, and getting to the point in her life where, you know, in your 40s, you would usually be reasonably self-supporting, but she doesn't have any kids, and she's still living hand-to-mouth, and she feels sorry for herself. You know, a lot of people who go into the arts have this idea of themselves that they are part of the elect and the world owes them a living because, you know, they're making beautiful things. And her brother is just this boring businessman type who has lots of money. And as far as Beryl is concerned, since he has some money, it's the same thing as an infinite amount of money. She just thinks, oh, her brother's rich and therefore should pay for everything. And therefore, when their father has a fall and they have to decide what to do with him because it seems as if he's not going to be able to take care of himself anymore, whose problem is it, right? And, you know, because this is the way we divide off roles in families, I think this is a pretty typical situation whereby there'll be one sibling who just takes responsibility for everything, and that's Shep. And as far as Beryl is concerned, it's just not her problem. And Beryl, meantime, has moved into the family home in New Hampshire, Berlin, New Hampshire. It's pronounced Berlin. I love that.
It's spelled like
the
Berlin,
capital of
right.
Germany. She's moved into her father's house to save money because she got kicked out of her rent control in New York. I repeat, said Shep. How much exactly do you think this house is worth? What? $500? $750? With that big backyard, I don't know. Maybe even $1 million. Shep knew his sister loved this house, and to some degree for good reason. The dark interior woodwork was all original and had never been painted over. It was spacious, and it had funk. The place had further appreciated in her head for being where she grew up. And her memories were pleasant. She'd always been the favorite. He hated to burst her bubble, but realtors were not so sentimental. I did some nosing around on property websites. Houses this big in Berlin are going for under $100,000. That's impossible! Fraser paper is closing and everybody knows it. Haven't you noticed how many vacant and derelict houses there are in this neighborhood? There's talk of building a big federal prison and an ATV park. But even if they happen, you're talking a few hundred jobs tops. After making reducing paperwork, you of all people should know that everybody's moving out. Property values in this area are falling. They're not falling anywhere. This house is the best investment Dad ever made. Beryl, think about it. Who wants to live here? Exiled New York documentary makers who lose their rent control. That's about it. And that's the real problem. Even if we put this place on the market tomorrow, it could sit there for months or even years, and meantime, Medicaid won't touch Dad's nursing home fees with a barge pole. So don't worry about its being sold out from under you. The worry is, it won't be. Well, we don't know how long he's going to last, right? I mean, I've always heard that for a lot of old people, a broken bone is the beginning of the end. This was ugly stuff. Yeah, if only he'd die right away, you could get your inheritance. Shep gave the last word a final hiss. I don't appreciate that insinuation. I was just saying. Shep collected the plates. He stood beside the stack, debating. He almost let the proposition go, but maybe it was having Dad down for the count at Androscoggin Valley. He was starting to feel less like Beryl's brother than her father. The longer Dad is able to keep living at home, said Shep, the better it is for him and the better it is for us. But live-in help would be expensive and, as you pointed out, intrusive. So I'm curious. There's one possibility we haven't talked about. What if he came back here and you took care of him?
No way!
She exclaimed. Clearly, this option had never entered her head.
Lionel Shriver reading from So Much For That. You know, this whole relationship and what goes on around the property, that house, and Beryl's insistence on taking it over and that Shep should just butt out, reminded me a bit of another one of my favorite books of yours, which is A Perfectly Good Family, which I think was from 1997. And, gosh, a whole different lifetime ago, really, for you. But in that, too, there are siblings just feuding after their parents die at that point about a house. And this, to me, again, sort of when people begin to look at themes in your work, you know, the stuff that we just can't bear to talk about openly is what you are known for. And I'm sure there's plenty of siblings who could pick up these passages or that book, hand it to somebody and say, you know what, turn to page 284. I'd like you to read that. And just use your book as like, you know, sort of a judge and jury.
I've actually had a couple of people tell me that they sought out A Perfectly Good Family once a parent died, and they go through that business of having to go through the things and resolve what happens to the house. It's very traumatic, and it brings out all of the worst between you and your siblings. And A Perfectly Good Family is good therapy for these people.
I'm not sure. Would you say it was good good therapy for you and your family?
No, it wasn't. But then my parents are still alive.
There's a very great article on this. I mean, really, some of my favorite work of yours is not even just your books, but your columns for The Guardian and other the places that you write. And you wrote one that I think was titled, I sold my family downriver for a good manuscript, was the name of one article, which details what actually happened as a result of that book, even though it's dedicated to your parents. But I have to think that you, unlike a lot of authors, probably engender in your readers like a certain sort of confessional familiarity. Like people must come up to you, whether it's to talk about in the wake of we need to talk about Kevin, where maybe parents secretly confided to you that, yes, indeed, they hated their kids from the get-go.
They did.
I'm sure they did.
They did.
Or after, okay, wait, and or then the whole group that came up to you after, oh, my favorite, the post-birthday world, thinking about, well, should I have kissed that guy? My whole life could have been different. Or why did I kiss him and run off with him? I was a schmuck. I should have stayed with my husband. That you, and maybe this too, I have to imagine, there are going to be people thinking, you know, I wish I'd encouraged my wife to pull the plug sooner or whatever. But, yes, tell us about that now.
Listen, this is one of the perks of my trade. I get everybody's stories, and I love it. You know, it's become part of the ritual of doing festival events, for example, is that when in the signing queue, I get new ideas for books.
You might get some here today.
Yeah, I mean, people come up and tell me their life story. And it's great. Post-birthday was especially like that, because post-birthday is about a woman who has to choose between two men. And in the book, you get both stories, right? You get both futures with one man and the other. And both men have problems, both men have advantages, so it's not very clear which man she's better off with, and it's kind of left up to the reader which you would choose. But I continually had people come up to me and say, well, you know, I had to choose between a Ramsey and a Lawrence, and, you know, I went with Ramsey, and it was a disaster. Or, you know, I ended up staying with Lawrence, and, you know, I broke my own heart. I really should have gone off with my Ramsey. You know, these characters became archetypes. And, you know, when I wrote that book, I had no idea how many people were out there who had to choose between the same types of romantic objects.
Well, for people who are fans of that book, and there are many, and I know that it was, to a large extent, I mean, the background of that book was also just interesting in the wake of the Kevin book. Let me just go back to this, that if people like the post-birthday world, if they're listening to this and they read it, it turns out that too had parallels in your life, and that you actually did marry Ramsey.
Or more or less.
A sort of Ramsey. Well, and I can tell
although Ramsey is a snooker player and my husband is a jazz drummer, and I have to say that I only realized this in retrospect, but I think what I did is I took his drumstick and elongated it. kind of like a drumstick with an erection.
I was going to say, that's very Freudian. Whew. Well, the description you had of Ramsey in the post-birthday world, when I went into a deep Google search looking for what your husband looks like, and he's exactly how I pictured him from your description. So, and there was a lot about how Ramsey in the book had been formerly married to the woman's agent, which is actually what happened in your life. He was married, Jeff Williams, married to your former agent. The agent who rejected...
Although the story, you know, I know that sounds very racy. And the real story is not as fun as it seems. That is, there was no overlap.
I know. So and you point that out.
I did not have an affair with my agent's husband. I am not that self-destructive.
But wasn't she your agent when she rejected outright because she was allegedly disgusted by it or something?
She hated We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Right. So that was it. You were done with her. Mm-hmm. You sold it. You sent it to 30 different publishers. You did get an agent in the United States, but 30 different publishers in the UK rejected the book that then became this prize winner, the Orange Prize. And, you know, how about that for a, like, up yours moment?
Oh, I think that's one of those stories that other writers and people who aspire to become writers love, and they should love it. It's one of those, you know, Doris Lessing did an experiment with sending one of her manuscripts around, and it was rejected by everybody. And, you know, I can definitely testify that it's an arbitrary world out there. And it's not a matter of, oh, you know, the cream rises to the top. That's not the case. And I am absolutely certain, for example, that, you know, here's HarperCollins. They're putting a lot of effort behind my new book. They sent me on tour even though... You know, these days a lot of authors are not sent on tour, so I'm getting a lot of support for this, right? But if Kevin had not taken off, I could send this manuscript to HarperCollins. I could send it to the same editor, and she'd reject it. You know, it's just a crapshoot, and I won at craps, right?
This is a good moment for anybody who wants to ask a question to make your way to one of the microphones, and please do. We want you to ask your question, so get over there. One of the things that I was very curious about in reading the book was your choice of this place, Pemba, which I had never heard of, this island, where Shep has decided that's where we're going. We're going to Pemba. That's where he buys his tickets for. It's an island off the coast of Africa. And in reading a little bit more about that, I find, and I doubt this is something that would have happened in this country, that you were just like raked over the coals by the Times Online for accepting, and you think Fundu Lagoon, where they end up, or where he wants to go, and you thank them for letting you have this wonderful moment there. I thought, great, that sounds great. But man, were they mad at you in the UK over that, even though you had been sent to do a travel story about that
place?
Yeah,
I was sent by the Sunday Times on a travel assignment. I combined a travel assignment with doing research on my book. Does this sound evil to you? I mean, like horribly corrupt and a big expose? Honestly, I don't know how they got this this article out of it. And it was in the Sunday Times, and it was that newspaper that sent me on this. And ordinarily, resorts and hotels give complimentary stays to travel writers with the understanding that there are no promises. And, you know, if that's corrupt, then every travel assignment is corrupt. But, you know, I'm afraid it's an example of British journalism at its worst. And it's one respect in which American journalism has it over on British journalism. Journalists here are a lot more responsible. And journalism in Britain is often, it's looking for some weak point. It's trying to get one over. It's a very envious culture, and I think that what made that journalist mad is that I was doing my work and I had a good time.
Well, we might not let you say the seven words that they let you say on the air in England, but at least we wouldn't have reviled you for taking a great vacation that you then wrote about in a book. So let's take some questions here, Lionel.
I have a question about We Need to Talk About Kevin. After I'd read it, I read several interviews with you where you talked about how just because the author was telling you something didn't mean that it was true, which I thought was pretty revelatory. It kind of never occurred to me before. So my question was, when you were writing that, did you know when she wasn't telling the truth and when she was?
Well, you know, yes, she's often cited as a classic unreliable narrator,
right.
But I think that that's important to clarify because it's a certain kind of unreliability. It's not that she's a factual liar. So I expect you to believe everything that she tells you in terms of, you know, if she says that she went to the cinema, she didn't secretly go to the supermarket, right? But there are different kinds of lying. And I suspect she's guilty of lies of omission. For example, you don't ever get stories about her son that, he drew her a Valentine or something, you know, happy stories. She's left all those out, mm-hmm. Right? And also you can lie in terms of just the way you tell a story. And if you look at a number of incidents early in the novel when Kevin is portrayed as being really creepy, right, what he's actually done is incredibly small, or maybe he hasn't even done anything. A classic example is when he's caught with a little girl who has eczema and she's scratching open the itchy scabs and starting to bleed. And the way Eva tells that story, it does seem really evil. But if you think about it, the poor little kid is just standing next to a little girl who's scratching herself. Does that sound really terrible? So that's it. It's in that sense. She stacks the deck a little, but it's really in terms of storytelling, not outright lying.
Here's another question.
You had a lot of books and a lot of years before We Need to Talk About Kevin and the recognition that came with it. Did you ever get discouraged during
Very. Are you kidding?
You almost
yeah.
gave up, right?
I mean, I came very close to giving up. And if Kevin had never been published, and it came awfully close to not getting published, I was going to have to do something else. And I think that, you know, that would have been practical. I didn't have any ambition to write a bunch of novels for the desk drawer or the hard drive. To me, novels are about communicating with other people, and if I could get them published, then I probably would have gone on to just become a full-time journalist.
Go ahead.
Well, I want to tell you that my whole book group is here. We've read Kevin, and we've read The Post-Birthday World, and we're great fans of yours. So based on those two books and what I've heard of your latest book with the stock portfolios at the beginning of each chapter, I've come to feel that structure is as much an element of your fiction as character, plot, setting, and it's so interesting what you do with structure, so I just would hope that you could talk about that a little bit, how you come to those structures, how you...
that sounds like a really big question.
Well, I will say that I am one of those writers who plans everything out before starting the book. That doesn't mean that I've worked out every detail. That would be tedious. I mean, working out every detail is writing the book. But I'm often asked, well, you know, did you know the ending? And of course I know the ending. I always know the ending before I start a book. It may change a little as I write it. I remember having problems when I was writing Kevin. I couldn't, there was a feeling of writing in place. I couldn't get the kid old enough. And at a certain point, skipped from the age of 7 to 14 just because we needed to get this story moving. Thank you very much. But I like to have an almost sculptural feel for a novel before I start it. At least have it in a roughed out sense so that I know the shape of it. And I know what kind of a climax I'm driving toward. I know generally what kind of a resolution I'm going for, and I know thematically what it's about. Who the characters are starts out a little schematic, and that gets fuller in the process of writing the book. But I just figure I save myself a lot of trouble by planning it out ahead of time, because otherwise you can write yourself up blind alleys and end up having to throw out a lot of text.
Could I just clarify one thing?
No. You can't, because you're not a microphone. But we have one more question, but you can talk to her after this. How's that? One more question. Thanks.
You mentioned journalism in the U.S. and journalism in the U.K. You could just explain a little on healthcare and healthcare reform in the U.K. and the U.S., if you could.
Oh, ew.
Okay. We need reform here, and they don't. I'm a big advocate of a single-payer system. I've been living in Britain for the last 23 years. I can testify that it works. I can testify that the parody of that system that you're given in the American media of long queues of feeble, ill people dropping like flies waiting for surgery for many years is not true. That is not what happens. The waiting lists in the UK are quite short. It is true that they don't give you every drug and every treatment, but that's something that I think we need to come around to in this country too, because medical care, like anything else, has to give value for money.
Okay, just to bring it back real quickly to your future, is there going to be a movie of We Need to Talk About Kevin with Tilda Swinton? That was the last thing I read.
I have finally come to believe in the last 10 days that it's really going to happen.
Yay. That would be fantastic.
They have set the shooting date, April 19th. Put that on your calendars. And it's going to star Tilda Swinton and John C. Reilly. And apparently they found an unknown to play Kevin, whom I have never met, have not seen a picture of yet, so that'll be interesting. I have nothing to do with the production, though I do plan to show up in the front row with a big bag of popcorn. And if you read Post Birthday,
yes, popcorn figures
you
prominently.
Get the illusion.
Well, and then my last question before we go is, are you in the midst of another book now, or you got your next idea? Are you going to get it from signing books here tonight?
How is it that I'm going to be up here on this stage in Chicago and writing another book at the same time?
Well, you might be doing it in your, on somewhere.
I'm not that heroic. No, I'm going to wait till the publicity for this book is over before starting a new
one. You got the idea, though?
I've got an idea, but it's not very advanced. But for many years now, I've wanted to tackle the issue of immigration and especially try to be a little sympathetic with the side of the equation that where, you know, you're the host population and you're a little uncomfortable with it. And it's this is political dynamite, and I'm sure that I will hate myself for taking it on. It is self-destructive to come anywhere near this topic, but I can't resist it.
And we wouldn't expect anything less. And we are, I hope I'll have a chance to talk to you about it when you come back through again. Lionel Shriver, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming to Writers on the Record, and we'll see you all next month. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The people at Graver Capital Management, LLC, and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Our special thanks to everyone associated with the series at the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center, including Commissioner Mary Dempsey. Engineers are Eric Arunas and Leland Mosley. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer is Victoria Lautman. Graver Capital Management, LLC, proudly presents these broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which is also made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation.